Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we've been hearing in the news unemployment is near record lows, job creation is robust, the economy is growing, driven by a healthy consumer spending, and also the stock market has hit record highs in recent weeks. It's down a bit in the last few days, but we've seen those record highs in recent weeks. And yet, many Americans are not feeling good about the economy. And a new report shows that one in six full-time Iowa workers is struggling to afford the cost of basic needs. Also, demand at Iowa's food pantries is historically high. Today, we explore the apparent disconnect between mostly good economic news about the nation's recovery since the shock of the COVID pandemic and how many Iowans and Americans are experiencing it. Later this hour, I'll talk with Sean Finn. Sean is a policy analyst with the nonpartisan, nonprofit Common Good Iowa. He'll tell us more about which Iowans in particular are struggling most with this current economy. But before we zoom in to be more Iowa-specific with Sean Finn, let's get a bigger national picture of the economy and attitudes about it and this apparent disconnect from Ann Villamil. Ann is a professor of economics at the Tippey College of Business at the University of Iowa, and I spoke with her yesterday in our Iowa City studio. Hello, Ann.
Hello, Ben.
In 2021, the current president, Biden, inherited a post-COVID economy. He has battled in the past years surging consumer prices, joblessness, the persistent supply chain issues that presented themselves during the COVID pandemic. We've seen in the meantime jobless numbers drop, prices on some consumer goods, including groceries, energy, and housing, remaining high. How would you characterize the current state of our economy and its recovery from all the things that were thrown out of whack during the pandemic?
So the current economy is actually pretty good, and many people are surprised to hear that. So there are three key performance indicators. The first is gross domestic product, GDP, which is the size of all of the economy, all the goods and services in the economy. In the third quarter of 2023, that number hit 4.9%, which is a very, very high number for a developed country like the United States. We would expect GDP to be growing at the rate of 2 to 2.5%. So that was a very high reading. The fourth quarter reading was 3.4%. So the economy is growing. The second important number is the unemployment rate, which you mentioned, and that's 3.8%, which is a very good number by historical standards. The third metric is inflation. And inflation has been low for quite some time, since the 2008 financial crisis. And in fact, there were periods when we were worried about deflation destabilizing the economy. During the COVID crisis in 2020, which started in March 2020, and the economy was shut down, there was massive concern about the economy in terms of GDP did fall, in terms of unemployment increasing. It shot up to 15%, and there was massive concern about inflation. So there was tremendous policy intervention of both monetary policy and fiscal policy, and inflation continued to be low until it suddenly spiked up in really a period of months, to 9.1% as measured by the CPI. So that was a very, very serious concern. And so the Fed quickly started increasing interest rates. And in the course of a year, it increased interest rates dramatically. Now, we've actually been paused. The Fed has been paused, hoping that the economy is going to be in conditions that it thinks, the Fed thinks, is appropriate, and I'll unpack that in just a minute, so that they can start lowering interest rates. But the Fed has said, Chairman Powell and the other Fed governors say, we're not there yet, and we need to stand pat.
Mm-hmm. What, if any, connection there is there between the COVID monetary policy, the recovery package passed by the government, and the spike in inflation there? Is there a discussion among economists? Is there consensus among economists?
Sure. Most economists, I can tell you my view, but I think the Fed and even Secretary Yellen at the Treasury have indicated that we probably overshot a bit in terms of monetary and fiscal policy. But remember, when COVID hit, we were literally locked down. We didn't have vaccines. There was tremendous concern about what would happen to the economy. And I think the sense was better to err on the side of caution than to undershoot this.
Mm-hmm. So inflation is the big worry point right now, and the Fed is wrestling with this. Go on with your explanation of where we are.
So in terms of unpacking this, yes, inflation is the big worry, but I think one of the reasons people are concerned, or at the very least uncertain, is because we get a lot of good news is bad news. So ordinarily, we would think, gee, if we got a good GDP reading, that means the economy is growing. If the economy is growing, we're going to need more workers. Unemployment is going to be low. That's going to be very good for the economy. But the good news is bad news part of this is if the economy grows too quickly, then the Fed is concerned, and legitimately so, that inflation could increase. And economies function best when inflation is low and stable. And that's why the Fed has said again and again and again, we want inflation to be between 0 and 2%. We want inflation to return to 2%. And the good news about that is even though, so inflation has come down a lot. It's depending, there are different measures of inflation. And if we just want a rough number, 3.5 to 2.5% range is about the range we can think about. So it's certainly close to where the Fed wants it, and the Fed has indicated that they're not looking for substantially lower inflation. They want to be sure about the stable part. Are we going to stay there?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they're looking for.
Okay. Corporate profits have been really good in the last few years. I think historic levels there. And we've been hearing this term greedflation here, a term that describes when companies increase prices to take advantage of inflation, sort of mask the price increase, I guess you might say, increase their profits even when their production costs haven't risen the same amount as they're raising the prices. How much of that is a factor here, do you think?
Well, I think certainly policymakers are looking at this. There is a lot of concern about a higher level of antitrust enforcement action. So you see this particularly with regard to tech firms, but a harder look at various mergers. And it is true that profits are high. The one thing, though, I would point out about that data is if you look back over a little bit longer period of time, you see volatility in those profits. And so firms say, yes, at this point in time, our profits are high. But when, for example, COVID hit and many firms were locked down, there were tremendous concerns about keeping firms in business. And so we had all sorts of things to keep firms in business and workers at work. Mm-hmm. So looking at taking a little bit of a broader perspective is helpful for understanding that volatility. Because remember, part of what firms do is invest. And investment by its very nature is a long-term thing, right? I might plan a plant today and secure funding, and then I have to build it, then I have to staff it, then I have to spin up the operation to become efficient. So they're thinking long-term. But I think they're as you said, legitimately there are concerns about the level of profitability, and that's why there's greater attention to antitrust.
In just a moment, I want to ask you your thoughts about perceptions of our economy as revealed in numerous polls over the past few months. I'm sure you're acquainted with those. But before that, I want to get to some other sort of places where we feel the economy's not quite right. And one of those is certainly housing, real estate, and rental markets. Where does that figure into this picture about our economy? We're almost, well, frozen would probably be too much to say, but there's very low inventory
Yes.
in most housing markets. People are, well, I guess, frozen in their very low mortgages and happy to stay there or not. They're just not willing to move, right?
That's right. That's right. And that is because we have had low interest rates for quite a long time until relatively recently. So there are people with 2%, 3%, 4% interest rate mortgages who say, maybe it makes sense for me to move. But if I moved, I'd have to get another place and I'd get it at a much higher interest rate. So I'm going to stay put. And yeah, that's a case where supply and demand is a workhorse for economics. And so if you have the supply of housing fixed because people don't find it in their own interest to move because they have a low interest rate, or interest rates are high and it's hard to build new housing, then the supply is going to be relatively fixed. And as demand fluctuates, people want to get houses, that's going to drive the price up. So we're in an unusual situation right now. And in terms of what people are feeling, they're feeling this right now because it's happening. Mm. As you mentioned, there's not a big inventory of houses. People are looking, and you know, they can't find the places that at the prices that they can afford. So that's leading to some frustration. So usually what happens when interest rates are higher is that the price of housing drops. Right now, we have higher interest rates, and because we have this limited stock, housing prices are actually rising. And that's, you know, I just explained to you why that's happening, but that's not the usual case.
We'll be back after a short break with economist Anne Villamil. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
And we're back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we're exploring the apparent disconnect between the mostly good economic news in our country and how many Iowans are experiencing it. Let's get back to the rest of my conversation, recorded earlier this week, with Anne Villamil, professor of economics at the University of Iowa Tippie College of Business. She had gone through the principal metrics for measuring the current health of the economy, the growing GDP in the U.S., the labor market, inflation, which has come down significantly, as well as housing. I then asked her if there were any other metrics we should consider.
Well, those are certainly the big things that affect people. Of course, we can look at wages. Wages are actually growing now. On average, they increased 5% last year, and that sounds good, and it is good. But when inflation was high, economists look at something called real wages and real things, and that's the difference between the increase that you get from your employer in nominal terms and inflation. So now that inflation is down to between 2.5% and 3.5%, depending on the measure, people are getting real increases, right? If your wage goes up by 5% and inflation is, let's say, 3%, you still have a 2% increase in your wages. But that it doesn't always feel that way. Right? So economists are very good at doing this calculation, and people say, yeah, but this price went up, you know, another price went up, and that's true. On net, they really are getting these real increases. But again, that's part of this kind of vibe session thing, that people don't always feel it.
And how you use the term vibe session, which we're hearing, how do you define that?
Well, that's not a formal economic term, and it really is that you described it, and this is exactly right, that there's a disconnect between the data and the way that people feel. So I talked about those three main indicators. They are GDP is good, unemployment is good, and inflation is getting better, but people are not feeling that. As a matter of fact, when you look at various surveys of consumer confidence, the majority of people will say, I'm okay now, but what are your expectations for the future? They're concerned about the future.
And it's this uncertainty that you mentioned.
Yes, uncertainty. People don't like uncertainty, so that's part of it. But part of it, I think, is also when you've had this series of bad shocks. You know, COVID was a really terrible shock, and we're very fortunate that we very quickly developed vaccines and other therapeutics that really spread across the world because it was a global pandemic. But that was very much out of the blue. And then after that, we had supply chain shocks, and we realized, gee, we've been not diversifying our suppliers. And so when we can't import lots of things or all the many problems that we had, we couldn't get ships in and unloaded and all the types of things that happened. That was a shock for people and a very real shock because we either couldn't get things or prices spiked up because of the shortages. And then we've had a war between Ukraine and Russia, and we currently, at the very least, have great uncertainty in the Middle East. Now, wars are never good economic events, and of course, they're horrible events for lots of other reasons. But I mention those two factors because the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia are the three biggest suppliers of oil and gas in the world. And so when you have uncertainty in two of those three places for a primary input, meaning energy prices, that is concerning. And if you want to bring it down to sort of how a person feels, there has been, since COVID, the price of gas has fluctuated between $1.50 and $5 a gallon. And of course, everybody liked it when gas was $1.50 a gallon. But go back and think about when gas was $1.50 a gallon. It was when we were all locked down because of supply and demand again. When demand went way, way down, the price of gas fell. So I don't think anybody wants to go back to that situation. The price is now someplace in the middle. But as the price of gas goes up, or energy in general, people feel that in their pockets.
Mm-hmm. One factor you haven't mentioned, and I wanted to ask you about this, because I want to have politics as a factor here, particularly when people are answering poll questions about the economy. Something makes me think, and you can back this up or not, that people answering a poll about economics know why it's being asked. They think it has to do with our current hyperpartisan political environment. This is in some way to deal with the politics of the situation that the poll will be used for that purpose. And it makes me think that if you would change the occupant of the White House, for some people, they would change their view to a pollster on how they felt about the economy.
Yeah, that's actually clear in the polls. So the Gallup polls, as you probably know, Gallup was from Iowa. He was a graduate of the University of Iowa. He was editor of the newspaper, and he pioneered a lot of these polls. And in the current Gallup poll, there's a very clear difference by party. If you are a Democrat, you think that things going forward you think that things now are good and are going to be good going forward. And if you're a Republican, there are many Republicans who believe we're in a recession right now. We're not. I mean, that's very clear when you look at the data.
And in 2025, if Donald Trump is the president again, you would expect that to flip-flop in terms of partisan answers there.
Yes, yes. Although some of it, the U.S. has very, very good data. And things like how we define recessions, they're actually called by the National Bureau of Economic Research. These are a bunch of economists. They're just not a partisan group. So we have some objective information on whether we're in a recession or not. But, you know, in the previous political discussions, this idea of alternative facts was floated. And so we're not in a recession. We can look at, a long series of economic data. But that's, I think, where this vibe session thing comes in. And that is how people feel. And if I want to buy a house and interest rates are 7% and prices are going up, not down, which is a very unusual to situation in the economy, I'm going to be very frustrated.
Let's end this conversation by having you share your views on what you are watching in the future. I looked at a poll published in recent days by the Financial Times that shows voters broadly slowly warming to this economic recovery. Are you seeing a change in attitudes in polls?
So, yes, we are seeing things start to turn. And some of that is actually for real reasons, and that is that inflation is actually coming down. So when people's real wages are rising, it seems to have happened with a bit of a lag for people to say, I'm doing okay, and I've been doing okay now for a few months. So I think that's part of it. But I think a lot of this is going to depend on the uncertainty in the economy.
So what will you be watching in the coming months?
I will certainly be watching oil prices. That's important because oil is a primary input in the economy. So if the price of energy goes up, people will feel it very much in their pocketbooks. It will be a big drag for firms everywhere, from the airline industry to lots of manufacturers. So I think that's always an important thing, because I can't emphasize enough, we are not in a recession, but sometimes we're hit by things that could tip us in. And that could be two wars that go awry.
Yeah. And to sort of dovetail into my next conversation that is more Iowa specific, how would you say Iowa and the Midwest fits in with our current economic picture?
So Iowa, I think, is doing pretty well on average, but on average is not where people live. They live where they are. They want to know what's happening to me. So, for example, Iowa's unemployment rate is almost always below the national level. So that's a good thing. Typically, we look at unemployment rates and we say, that's great. But it makes it hard often for firms to get workers. And if you're someone who doesn't have a job or doesn't have a good job and you are in a food pantry, you're not going to be feeling very good about the economy.
Indeed. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for your views. Anne Villamil is at the University of Iowa, Tippie College of Business, professor of economics. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
In that conversation with Anne recorded earlier this week, now back live, it's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, if you've been tuned in, we're exploring the apparent disconnect between mostly good economic news about the nation's recovery since that shock of the COVID pandemic and how many Iowans are experiencing it. They're not feeling that it's a great economy. Joining me for the rest of the hour, Sean Finn, policy analyst with Common Good Iowa, a nonpartisan, nonprofit policy research and advocacy organization. Hello, Sean.
Hello.
Great to have you on the program. I know you have a report to share some findings about with us in just a moment, but since we just listened to Ann Villamil give us sort of a macroeconomic view of the country and her view on, you know, the perceptions mismatching some of the mostly good economic data, I would like your reaction to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think Anne covered some excellent ground, and I don't really have any refutations of anything she had to say. I think in Iowa, we're seeing a lot of the similar trends that we're seeing at a national level when it comes to inflation, when it comes to wages. As Anne was mentioning, Iowa does tend to do better on some metrics compared to the nation overall. So, for example, our unemployment rate is lower than the national rate. And that's a positive thing for the state. But we definitely want to dig a little deeper into what's behind those numbers and how are people actually doing in the economy, because we know from what we've heard and from people, and we know from the numbers that we calculated in our report, our cost of living report, that Iowans are actually having a hard time of it in this post-pandemic economy.
Okay, to tee that up, let's listen to some voices from Iowans. As we said, you know, unemployment near record lows, job creation robust, economy growing, GDP and so forth, stock market until recently hitting record highs. It's come back a little bit down from those record highs. But despite this, surveys show Americans say the economy is doing poorly. There's some uptick in that. We here at IPR asked Iowans around the state how they felt about the economy.
Not well. Things are just so expensive for what everybody's getting paid.
It's really bad right now because my family, who was doing a good like 10 years back, they were struggling, and sometimes we don't have a lot of money.
Everything is way too expensive. I have a child that is 3 years old, and it's getting really expensive for groceries and gas, basic necessities.
Obviously, over the years, you know, as you get older, you know, you want to make more money, but then I don't really see it just because, you know, we're paying so much more for everything. So, I mean, I understand that there are people saying that, you know, things are getting better or that they're okay, but I personally don't see it.
Yeah, well.
Some views from Iowans across the state. How are you experiencing our current economy? Join us 1-866-780-9100 or email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or if you just have a question for Sean, who is with us live for the rest of the hour. Sean, the voices we heard there tell me, I think, that they're matching up with perhaps what you found in this cost of living report.
Yeah, it sounds like it. One comment that I thought really told the story well is things are really expensive for what people are getting paid. And that's still what a lot of folks are feeling. If you look back at from January 2021 through, you know, mid-2023, you look at inflation over that time and it peaked at 9.1%. It's been really high. It's been above 4% for most of that time. And in that same amount of time, the average increase in wages for people have been below that for most of that time. So 4% and 5% across the board. So while folks have been, you know, looking at, oh, you know, wages are increasing, that's a positive news, the concept of real wages is what that person was really getting at. And Anne spoke to this in the past segment, but real wages is sort of is, you know, what can you actually buy with the money? Can your paycheck still afford the same things that you could afford with it last month, or can you not afford as much? And throughout this time, we know that real wages were, despite the fact that wages were growing, real wages were falling during this time. People weren't actually able to afford as much. And now that, you know, inflation is lower and wages are continuing to rise, we might see that real wages picking up allow people to feel better about the economy. But at this moment, people still aren't feeling that because the prices are still high from this really intense inflation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so based on what you're saying and what Anne said, we could be turning the corner in terms of real wages.
That's the hope. I think that there's a lot of hope around that right now with inflation remaining low, hopefully stable, and wages continuing to increase. That is hopefully turning around the economic picture for some families.
Sean, in about a minute, we have to go to break, but perhaps you can give us a teaser, a look at some highlights that you want to talk about in this report. What did this cost of living report examine?
Sure. So this cost of living report, it's our ninth edition of the report. It examines what does it cost a family to afford basic needs at their family size, how many families aren't able to afford that basic needs budget that we create, and what can we do about it in terms of policy solutions at the state and federal level in order to make it easier on working families.
Okay. And quickly, for those not familiar with Common Good Iowa, what is your mission? Who are you?
We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research and advocacy organization.
Okay. Sean Finn, policy analyst with Common Good Iowa, with us live for the rest of the hour. One of the parts of that report, one in six of all households with at least one full-time worker are still struggling to make ends meet. Perhaps that is you. Join us with your view on how you are experiencing our current economy. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a moment with more of our discussion.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
We're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, the apparent disconnect between mostly good economic news across the country since COVID, our recovery since then, and how many Iowans are experiencing it. If you'd like to join our conversation with your economic experience, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us, Sean Finn, policy analyst with Common Good Iowa, nonpartisan, nonprofit policy research and advocacy program. I know you have recommendations here too, but let's dig into the findings of this latest cost of living report, Sean, a little more and get to some email, some listener input here before that. Let's go for the main takeaways that you have in this ninth report.
Yeah, so in this ninth edition of the report, we found that one in six households with a full-time worker can't make a basic needs budget for their family type. And that's a really interesting number because the last time we did this report a couple of years ago, we found that one in seven families were struggling to make ends meet. And so, you know, that leap from one in seven to one in six is very indicative of how people are dealing, are doing in this economy. Families are having a really hard time struggling to keep up with inflation with their wages. So we look at, you know, how does this play out across different family types? And we know that single people, about a quarter of single people can't afford a basic needs budget. And well over half of single parents aren't able to afford a basic needs budget. And so when people aren't able to afford these budgets, and I should mention these budgets that we create for the report, we call them basic needs because they are really, really bare bones. We don't include luxuries. We don't include a lot of things that most people would probably consider to be part of a standard budget, but we are really focusing on what it takes to survive and not what it takes to thrive in Iowa. So when we put these budgets together and we look at, you know, how people stack, people's incomes stack up against them, that's where we come around, come out with this one in six number and these statistics on how many families aren't actually able to afford these budgets.
Right. And two questions about that, about the not meeting the basic needs from one in seven to one in six families statewide struggling to meet these basic needs. How are people in this group coping if they can't meet basic needs? Where do they turn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's where you see people turning to things like food pantries and food banks. We know from those folks that they are being absolutely slammed with people coming in and needing food assistance. People are turning to other sources for transportation. Maybe they sell their car and do public transportation. Maybe they can't afford childcare, so they drop off kids with a neighbor or let some of their other kids look after younger kids. And generally finding ways to avoid some of these expenses. And oftentimes that may come at the cost of family's health, at their ability to, you know, have food or to go and do activities or learn for the kids. So we see people cutting their budgets and cutting down as much as possible. And then on the other side of that, we see a lot of people going into debt because they can't afford these basic needs. So people putting costs on their credit cards or, going into medical debt or, other extensive debt. And that's also really damaging to the long-term economic stability of that family.
When we talk about basic needs, are things like cell phones, Wi-Fi included in that? Because in our modern economy, we'll try to work or live without those things, and that would be difficult, wouldn't it? Is that a basic need? Are those things?
Yeah, we don't include a cell phone bill in this in our budget. We include rent and utilities and food, healthcare, childcare, clothing and household expenses and transportation, and that is all that we include. So it's a very limited budget.
The basic basics.
Exactly.
Very basic.
Exactly.
Okay, and who, what can you tell us about the demographics, the groups in particular that are struggling most in Iowa?
Sure, yeah. So we talked a little bit about single parents being a group that is struggling immensely with these basic need budgets. And then when you look at the ability to pay for these budgets by race and ethnicity, we find that while overall 1 in 6 families are struggling to make ends meet for these budgets, when you look at Black and Hispanic families in the state of Iowa, that number is more like 1 in 3. And so this is hitting Black and Hispanic families very hard. And
why should it be hitting these families harder?
Great, yeah. This is happening, and we really dug into this more in this edition of the report, digging into the historical reasons for the current economic disparities we see. So if you look back at policy decisions throughout the history of Iowa, you see ways in which the state has made it difficult for people of color, Hispanic families, Black families to build wealth, to establish themselves in communities. We talked in the report about the history of redlining in the state of Iowa, which made it very difficult for especially Black families to get home loans in mm-hmm. cities and urban areas. We also talked about exclusions from labor protections. Labor protections such as minimum wage and overtime requirements only apply to certain occupations, and it excludes agricultural workers and domestic workers. And at the time that that was created, those were the two main areas with the highest concentration of Black workers. So these labor exclusions from decades ago continue to the present day and still make it harder for people in those occupations to get by. So mm-hmm. we really dug into some of those historical explanations for why we are here today where we are with these disparities.
Sean, perhaps a good time. We won't be able to cover all the points in this new report. How can people find that report from Common Good Iowa?
Yes, please go to commongoodiowa.org, and you should see it right on our front page. It's called The Cost of Living in Iowa, and a simple Google search should get you that report.
Okay. Sean Finn, policy analyst with Common Good Iowa. Another 10 or so minutes we have with Sean. Let's get some input from our listeners. Jeff is joining us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. What's your economic experience here that you want to chip in?
I've gone from homeless basically in 2020. I had a kind of a bad car accident where I was laid up for a while. But regardless, I'm doing really well. I just bought a house last year. My wages haven't gone up per se, but I've been able to supplement with a second job. And, granted, I don't have kids, so I don't understand, I do, but they're grown. I don't empathize so much with what their situation is and the minorities as well. I know it's tougher for them. But, man, I'm doing really good.
Jeff, when you hear that we have a good economy, you're not cringing, I guess, it sounds like.
I like what Biden's doing, as far as these tax. I want to see him back in the White House. I fear a Trump economy with import tariffs and whatnot that he's threatening and cutting back what they're calling, I can't even think of the word they're using.
Yeah,
for
all right. Jeff.
Cutting back Social Security, Medicare. But I'm doing really well. I mean, you got to work for it, but, and things are
Jeff,
here at the grocery store.
Jeff in Cedar Rapids, from being homeless to saying you're doing really well, I applaud you for that. Congratulations. Nice to hear. Bye, Jeff.
Bye. Thanks.
All right, let's go to Casey in Des Moines. Hi, Casey. Welcome to the program. You have a question or a bit of your experience to share?
Yes, good morning, and I appreciate all the things that you do. I listen to you guys every day. But I don't understand where they get those numbers from. For example, that lady just had on the phone there, saying, Sean, talking about somebody selling their car to supplement. Well, we're giving all the billions and billions of dollars to Israelites and Ukraine and all that stuff, but American citizens, ourselves, we can't afford to have a good living. We can't even make ends meet. But you're giving billions of dollars to other countries. On top of that, the state of Iowa, they know all those policymakers in that state capital down there making all these racially biased policies that is affecting their minorities and everything, and they know about it. And there's still nobody is saying or speaking to anything to that effect.
Okay, Casey, thank you very much for your view. I think we got it. And we will, in fact, have Sean give his view on policy out of Des Moines, in fact, Casey. So people are talking about it. But to Casey's first question, Sean, where does this data come from that you draw on for the Common Good Iowa reports?
Yeah, that's a great question. We draw on a bunch of different data for these cost of living reports, a bunch of state and federal data, including survey data, data on food plans from the USDA, Housing and Urban Development, Department of Transportation. So we pull together a bunch of different resources to find out what these budgets should look like. And then we pull from national survey data of Iowans to find out how many Iowans are struggling to meet these budgets.
Okay. Let's go to the recommendations part of this report. What are Common Good Iowa's recommendations based on the findings you have here? Let's go through that list. I know you have a number of them.
Yes, we do. So I'm going to focus on a few of these today that I think we view as some really important recommendations. So one is to expand and strengthen tax credits. Tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, often shortened to EITC, and the Child Tax Credit, which is a federal credit that was expanded during the pandemic era. Iowa has its own EITC that was originally passed in 1989. It was signed by Governor Branstad. And this is a matching amount of a federal credit. And it rewards people who work and are low income and gives them a refund that they can use for their expenses or to reduce their tax burden. It's been proven to be great at reducing poverty and helping out the people who need it most. And so we recommend expanding and strengthening the EITC and establishing a state child tax credit as well. We also look at addressing the cost of childcare in the state, so increasing child care assistance program, allowing more people to be eligible for that program by income level. And this one in particular is very key for increasing workforce participation, which is still not recovered in the state of Iowa. We also would love to see the state ensure that families have resources for food. Things like accepting the federal summer EBT program dollars so that families with kids can feed their kids in the summer, and then investing in food banks and double up food bucks in the state. And these are great programs for ensuring people get access to food. But at the root of it, we want families to be able to afford food on their own. So doing something like increasing the minimum wage. The state hasn't increased the minimum wage in a very long time. It's still $7.25. And we know that across policy areas, across family types, people know that $7.25 is not enough to get by for a family. So we want to see the increase in the minimum wage and allow localities throughout the state to set their own minimum wages. That's something that the state doesn't allow right now. And one big finding in the cost of living report is that the cost of living does vary quite dramatically across the different areas of Iowa. Certain counties have much higher housing costs, for instance, and so it just makes sense that if a certain area has a higher cost of living, that they should be able to set a higher minimum wage.
Sean, our time is disappearing. I wanted to get some more listener input, a lot of interest here. Laura in Marion, her comment boils down to this. She says the hike in prices has more to do with corporate greed than inflation. Corporations posting record profits, increasing the millions of dollars to their CEO and paying for that by increasing the price of their items. Your view on that in a nutshell?
I think she's onto something there. I think that people have every right to be upset about the record kept corporate profits at the same time that prices are going up from these same corporations. You look at the overall GDP increasing, these positive economic numbers. The total sum of money that we have as a country is very great, but how is it distributed? A lot of people who work really hard don't get to see their share of those profits.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ann in Des Moines. Welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting, Ann. Not much time. Jump in here quickly, please. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to, first of all, say thank you so much to Common Good Iowa. I work at an anti-poverty nonprofit, and we utilize your data every day to help us better understand the situations families are facing. And I just wanted to say for the listeners, you know, families in this situation where they can't meet their basic needs often have one of two issues. One is internal barriers to being able to do that. And then there's the external barriers to being able to do that. And we focus a lot on the internal barriers. In other words, what is the family doing wrong or not doing that they can't meet their basic needs, instead of focusing our attention on these systemic and more broad issues such as livable wages, cost of childcare, cost of housing. So we see in our work that those external systemic problems are really where we should be putting our attention. So I wanted to hear what you all think about that.
Okay, Anne, thank you very much for your input from Des Moines. Anne, apparently working in an anti-poverty organization. We have about a minute left. Sean.
Yeah, thank you,
Anne. Do you want to wind up this? Yeah. Comment on Anne's and emphasize the points you'd like to finish up our conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you, Anne. And it's great to know that our data is useful. You can go to commongoodiowa.org to see the report, and we also have an interactive data tool there. You can look at your specific county to see what a basic family budget looks like for your county in particular, and for your family type. So that's a really great resource that we hope people will use. And as we look forward into the future, we hope that we can find some common ground at the State House on policy solutions like expanding tax credits and helping out families with childcare, because this really is, you know, for the common good, and that's what we're all about. And so we hope to find common ground on that.
How optimistic are you in a few words about finding common ground, a better direction as far as you're concerned with policy here in Iowa?
Well, it's certainly not going to happen this legislative session. None of our policy recommendations look to be implemented this time around, but we're going to keep pressing and hopefully having conversations that really put Iowa families first.
Okay, thank you very much for coming into our studio, Sean Finn, policy analyst with Common Good Iowa. And once again, Sean, it's commongoodiowa.org to find out more information, right?
Yep, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Tomorrow on the program, it's a NewsBuzz edition. Jared Strong of Iowa Capital Dispatch will be with us on a how two veterinarians solved a cow sickness whodunit. And plenty more tomorrow on the program. Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman with help from Samantha McIntosh and Sheila Brummer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.